Excellent. Well, welcome
Welcome
to
to
everybody that
everybody.
has joined today. And good morning or afternoon, depending on where you are joining from. And this is our first webinar of 2026. And looking at the participants and attendees list, it's great that we're kicking off with a nice attendance of people that that want to hear about all things. Reflecting back on 2025. So that's what we're doing today. We are reflecting, looking back at some of the attacks and hacks that shaped the year and what we have, should, or could learn from them. 2025 was definitely the year for high impact, highly visible campaigns, especially in the UK, but also around the globe. And I'd say probably the most since 2017, when we were all working very hard to help secure and recover from WannaCry and NotPetya. And yes, do you know what? We've had other big events that have dominated past years, like Kaseya, Hafnium, SolarWinds, Log4Shell, Heartbleed, if we go back far enough, and plenty of others. But I think the events over the last year or the previous year, really caused organizations and their boards, most importantly, to sit up and not just take notice of cybersecurity, but very much put it as a priority. And very similar, as I said, to the aftermath of WannaCry. But obviously, as much as possible, we don't want to be closing the gate after the horse has bolted. But it's important that we take the learnings from this. And I can say that through the conversations that I have with a lot of our customers, that it really has focused their mind and looking at, how can we make sure that that we're not the next organization that that has such an impactful breach. And we're actually, with all of the talk about AI and technology at the moment, organizations involved in a lot of these breaches were compromised very much through simpler methods. And that should tell us, a part or an angle of what we should focus on for 2026. So let's dive in, we'll dissect, look at the learnings that we can take from the attacks of 2025. But before I do that, as I just flick my slides on, I would like to introduce my esteemed colleagues that are joining me today to discuss the topic and reflect back. So first, we have Brian Martin. Brian is our Director of Product Management, responsible for managing and developing the group's portfolio of cybersecurity services and solutions. Brian has extensive experience in his career across IT, software development, telecoms, most importantly, the last 10 years focused on cybersecurity in all its aspects. That's regardless of technology, service, people, process, and best practice. So welcome, Brian. We're also joined by Martin. Martin, having grown up in San Antonio, Texas, he's got a passion for cybersecurity that dates back as far as 1999. His focus on preventing cyber attacks from happening is what has made him an excellent tracker of potential risks and weaknesses within systems, and has that in-depth knowledge of how to mitigate them. He founded Enclose in 2006, that became part of the Integrity family last year, where he managed that organization as the technical director for 18 years. So a wealth of experience and knowledge. And now is, not only was the brainchild of CyberFire MDR, but now leads our entire MDR practice. And then last, but definitely not least, we have Patrick Ragg. Patrick is our incident response manager, heads up our incident response team. Joined Integrity 360 in 2021 from Avnet, where he led and head their incident response, overseeing incidents across EMEA, the Americas, and Asia Pac, supporting over 1,500 employees. And he runs the team that help all of our customers day in, day out, one of our busiest teams, when they're in their moment of crisis. So welcome to my guests. And what I'll do is I will
Thanks, Rich.
just stop sharing there, because we don't need any slides today. Today we are having I think what is our preferred webinar method is having a fireside chat or a roundtable chat with our experts. And so just before we kick off, I'll just remind everybody that we have a QA function. You should have that at the bottom of your Zoom window. So please make use of that. Please ask us questions, and we'll have a dedicated session to answer those at the very end. When we were preparing for this webinar, there was no doubt in any of our minds of where we should start when we're reflecting and looking back. And that has to be the UK retail attacks. They've got so much press, so much impact. They were nicely timed with Easter, to make them as impactful as possible. And these attacks brought two national retailers very much to their knees. And in the case of Marks and Spencer's, for a significant amount of time, we saw, and I saw definitely firsthand that we had empty shelves and customers unable to buy or place orders. So I'd say it's probably the worst case scenario when it comes to retail. Now, Patrick, I'm going to come to you, and I'm probably going to come to you for to set the scene on each one of the attacks that we're going to look at and breaches that we're going to look at today. And obviously, the retail attacks, talking about this is probably a well-trodden path, and we could easily drop into spending half an hour on this alone. And I think, in fact, if I look back to the webinar that we did, I think it was in May time, then we spent about 50 minutes diving down into just one of those attacks. So let's not spend 50 minutes on that today. So just a high level, particularly now the dust is well and truly settled. What did happen across Harrods, Marks and Spencer's, and Co-op Group?
So it was during the Easter period of 2025. I call it the Easter trio. Basically, M&S, Co-op, and Harrods, three major retailers in the UK. And I think Marks and Spencer's and Co-op have obviously got businesses around Europe as well. But yeah, they were all hit by the same threat actor, so Scattered Spider, which were affiliated with the Dragonforce ransomware. So Dragonforce ransomware being used as a ransomware as a service, and then Scattered Spider was the underlying, the motivated group actually doing the breach. It was a coordinated campaign. Obviously, the Easter period was extremely busy as well for retail. Business, retail organization with, buying Easter eggs and all that kind of stuff. So it was a perfect time to attack. And in all three attacks, the root cause was thought to be the impersonation of IT staff. So basically, the social engineering of help desk personnel to grant them access into the environment. And it is widely reported that M&S, for example, was using a third party IT contractor. Also, that was also managing their critical infrastructure. Essentially, yeah, the initial access was a social engineering breach, and then once they're in, the threat actors were there for a number of months, and they were using legitimate tools, so living off the LAN to move around, and then the underlying VM environment, which is VMware, they use they basically compromise the ESXIs and then perform the encryption that way. So, just to sum up, M&S was 46 days total shut down. Co-op was a slightly different. Co-op actually just totally cut their network off, so they pulled the plug. And then Harrods was actually detected early in the kill chain, so they actually managed to prevent quite a bit of data theft and operation disruption.
Just so Patrick, just on the and the co-op is kind of being shown a bit of a great example. In fact, the UK NCSC, as part of their annual report, they released say, November December time in 2025, which is a really good read. So I would encourage anybody to have a look at that. But in fact, actually, I think the second page was an open letter from the CEO of Co-op Group, partly praising their team, which is hugely important, and acknowledging all the hard work they did, but really highlighting the reason that they were able to minimize the impact of it was their level of preparedness and prepared to act. to make those difficult decisions, which I know is something that that you preach about quite a lot, particularly going from one incident to another, the level of preparedness impacts that. And I just, conversely, which I think is quite interesting, talking to PR and crisis management teams that work in the assisting organizations when they've been hit by breach, because it's not all just Patrick and his team and other incident responders from a technical level, but there's obviously PR and legal elements that we all need to join together. But I thought it was quite interesting that the PR teams are actually, on the PR side, Marks and Spencer did a much better job than Co-op, even though it was a lot more impactful. So I guess what I'd be interested in is, you talked about Harrods, Marks and Spencer's and Co-op, very different profiles in terms of impact. What do you see as the real difference between those three?
I mean, jumping to Co-op, obviously they had the nuclear option ready. They were able to actually shut everything down. I think from M&S, I think that their infrastructure was so convoluted, so mass, so big and complex that I don't think they'd have been able to shut everything down if they wanted to. I think they might be able to shut down the core distribution centers, but then all the shops would still be open and so on. So there was no kind of centralized, big red button. And then with Harrods, I mean, Harrods, there wasn't a lot of information out there on Harrods. They kept obviously they stopped the attack early. Some data was able to be was able to be stolen, but yeah, I mean, just focusing on M&S and Co-op. I mean, I think that there's pros and cons to turning, hitting the big red switch. There's pros and cons to that, but with the M&S one, it really showed that they should have had some sort of plan in place for that, because literally it was like cat and mouse with M&S. They were finding systems that were compromised, then and taking them down. Then a few days later, they were finding other systems that were still compromised, and it was totally cat and mouse. So it just pushed the can down the road. So.
And I suppose there's definitely a bit of size and scale makes that more, much more difficult. But the planning is pretty key. Are there any, just there's, we don't want to sit here and just talk about the woes and the impacts. I think importantly, what we need to talk about is kind of those missed opportunities and lessons learned. We can talk about the response. Is there any kind of other missed opportunities, lessons learned that we can take from this that is widely applicable or things that we should really be considering?
Yeah, I mean, and look, I wasn't in those breaches, so I can't comment and say, the exact lessons learned. But from my point of view, it was clear that there was a lack of not just a high level incident response plan, but a low level one as well. So we're talking low level technical, what to do when you see a machine that's compromised. I mean, if you're following the cat and mouse way of responding to the breach, so you find a few machines and you isolate them, then you move to the next. That's not a very efficient way of doing instant response, because the attacker is always going to be one step ahead of you. So it was clear that they didn't have like an overall plan as well as a low level plan. And then internal comms as well. Obviously, like I said, I wasn't in that incident, but from what I've gathered from various sources, there was lack of internal comms plan during those breaches, especially M&S. That just such a big complex organization. It was hard for different teams to say, that yes, it wasn't clear whose team owned which areas of the infrastructure, basically. So.
Okay, and also that's just what we know and what people have speculated on to a certain extent. But it is, it does point out the point that internal communication is important. So just I'll give you the last word on this, Patrick, and then give the other guys some a chance to chip in. But what about the attackers? What do we know about them?
Well, Scatterspider, who are the guys behind those three breaches, they're a native English-speaking group, which is really, really interesting. Active since 2022, These guys, I think a number of them actually got arrested. They got, I think it's four individuals, ages 17 to 20, got arrested in July last year. And they were, yeah, young native English speakers, which is, in my experience, that's quite unheard of. That's quite, you know, it's actually quite refreshing in a way. But these guys are, they focus on social engineering. That's their kind of mode. That's how they get in, is social engineering. I mean, obviously with the English speaking, native English speaking accent, it's a lot easier to breach an English company, a British company, because you know, otherwise it's going to be a bit harder. Yeah, they are known as part of the COM. So there's a kind of a loosely connected cyber criminal collective called the COM, which all share the same similar kind of campaigns, and affiliate style service offerings. And they work alongside Shiny Hunters, if you've heard, if people have heard of those guys, and then Lapsus as well. So they're kind of formulating a super group. So, you know, a cyber super group. Yeah.
We'll come on to that shortly. But yeah, John, I mean, they have been prolific, been successful. There was other arrests on top of those four that, and I think, with seeing that some of the senior people in there, having millions in terms of Bitcoin, so showing actually they are successful and they are extorting money. I think their casino attacks at John. Just off the top, I can't remember the value off the top of my head, but obviously, when they targeted Vegas, the house didn't win in that instance. Martin, I was going to say you're obviously down to Africa. I don't think I actually mentioned that, but as part of the my intro, so one continent away. What I'm curious about, did this have a similar impact on retail there? And I don't mean obviously attacks because I'm very focused on the UK, but in terms of, and I know that we work with some of the largest retailers in Africa. Did it affect their view? Did did they respond to it in any way to well, as I say, when working with other retailers in Europe, their response is actually, do you know what, we need to have a look and actually have conversations with the likes of M&S to go, what have you done since? What worked? From sort of the African perspective, how was that treated and responded to?
Yeah, so it certainly got everyone's ears up to see, just the volume and the concentration in the retail sector. What happened in the UK was it was quite surprising. Certainly, people were talking about it, probably at the board level more than on the ground. We don't shop from those organizations, so everything was working, and I think that what's generally causes a lot of noise is. When the public's not happy and they can't get access to services, then it makes big headlines. But certainly at the executive level and the board level, people were talking about it, understanding how could that happen, what needs to be done. And I think we had a bit of impact, not necessarily with the retail, but South Africa and Africa in general. I guess more South Africa is. Produces car parts, so I think one of the other breaches that we were going to talk about was the Land Rover and the supply chain and how that affected us. We had a similar situation with Toyota's breach. I don't know if that was last year or the year before. So generally, when we see breaches like that to happen to multinational companies, Africa doesn't make the headline, but it does have impact to us, and we see it and we talk about it. And certainly it makes us think about what we need to do. And we're not immune to those attacks, despite us being on the continent that maybe has the least technical infrastructure in that sense. It's worth pointing out that, the countries that are more advanced, I would say, or have more infrastructure, more GDP, like Nigeria, South Africa, Egypt, Kenya, they're the ones that are on the top of the kind of log in terms of African countries that are affected by it. But certainly by no means does that mean all the other countries aren't affected. It just isn't reported on. I think we actually see a lot of government attacks, so attacks happening on government. So yeah, certainly something that we were aware of. I think we were kind of glad that we weren't in the headlines in that sense, but it got everyone thinking and you know, chatting about it, which is good. You know, that visibility is good for the companies to see.
Yeah, and Brian, when Patrick covered some of the, I guess the root cause, we see a little bit of a common theme across these attacks.
We sure are, yeah. And I think the two main common themes that we're seeing again and again, one is the targeting of humans, of people, as being sometimes the most vulnerable part of the organization. So, gaining access to critical infrastructure via, you know, help desk scams or targeting help desk staff to assign either update passwords or to assign additional permissions is a common theme. We're going to see it again in one of the other attacks we're going to talk about. The second area then is the fact that there was a third party managing critical infrastructure, and that was obviously a key vector for deploying the ransomware and the malware. And we're seeing that again and again, that third party breaches are on the increase. According to the Verizon data breach report, third party, the percentage of third party breaches is up nearly 50% in the last year and have increased threefold since 2021. So clearly, the threat actors are seeing third party as a vector by which to economically breach many different organizations. In this case, they were able to breach three different organizations. And so that combination of, you know, whether you're breaching the staff of the target or of the third party, either way, it's a vehicle to get in. And then obviously when you compromise the third party system or the third party environment or the third party provider, that provides access then into the target environment as well.
It's not just the it's important to note it's not just the big MSPs as well that are being used for initial access. So in late 2025 we had three organizations, smaller MSPs, not security providers, but managed service providers. We're talking probably maybe 200 to 500 employees, and yeah, we had three where they were accessed, and then as a result of that, all of their customers were accessed as well. So it's not just your big, massive, thousands of employees ones. It's the smaller ones as well. It's a gold mine if you're an attacker is compromising an MSP. Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's an important point. You know, Brian, you call out the, that sort of 50% stat around third-party risk management. I think it's something that we'll be increasingly focused on. Is how can we not just, what things that we need to be doing is not, is on the one hand assessing our third parties and how much risk they pose to us. And that's got to be a top-down from the impact that they can have, excuse me, on our business. But also looking at how we, where possible, insulate ourselves from them, so that that we can contain. We should be well past the days of giving them raw access via VPN to the network, and thinking about things like zero trust network access, and we can get a whole conversation of zero trust and buzzword and hype word into reality, which is something we'll see over the course of this year. But there are definitely things that we need to think about.
Yeah, and also had to make the point that we can't just, protect ourselves by dispensing with third parties and trying to do everything in-house. In fact, the whole industry is going the other way. The percentage of organizations that are increasing their use of third parties and outsourcing, etc., is on the increase. And it's for very good business and strategic reasons that you outsource. So that you can focus on your core capabilities. But this kind of increase of the use of third parties combined with the increased targeting of supply chain and third party breaches means that we collectively have to up our game from a third party risk management point of view.
Yeah, Brian, just on the or anybody else that wants to jump in, what's the we talked about the third party risk that and look at how we can manage that. What's the what should we be doing to help with the human side of things?
I can give a initial response to that. So obviously it's that combination that we always talk about of, people, process, and technology. So you do need to have the, you need to have good processes, like for example, your help desk staff, and also you need to have protections in place and good, endpoint security and email security to protect and messaging security to protect your staff from the massive increase in the likes of phishing attacks, etc. But when it comes down to it, you need to build out a, go beyond just your regular training and awareness to start building out, building a secured, a security culture, and improve security behaviors across the entire organization. So investing in security culture and behavior programs, I think, is a key focus area for most organizations.
Yeah, go on, Martin, go on.
Yeah, I was just going to chip in. There was a little gap of silence when Rich asked that question because we all went to user awareness training, and we all know how frustrating that can be. Because yeah, we have to do it, and it definitely helps the employees. But it's definitely, if we talk about security, there's no silver bullet. And end user awareness training is not a silver bullet. It's particularly so, and we have to have other controls to help us, and we have to have other layers to help us in that space, because I think that's probably where you can spend as much money as you want on user awareness training. You're not going to get 100%. You're going to get far from 100%. There's always going to be those employees that are vulnerable, and that click on the link and give the password away over or reset the password. So I think that's the tough part that we have to deal with. But I think there are more controls being available to us now. But these things are changing all the time. If we look at multi-factor authentication, we thought that this was a silver bullet, but now we're seeing session hijacking happening, and it's being bypassed. So it's a cat and mouse game that we have to try to keep up with. Sorry, Patrick, you were gonna
Well, do you know,
talk
I'm
about
actually
it.
going to just jump in there because we've got to keep
I'll
things
let you.
moving along. And
Yeah.
yeah, just one, just I guess, interesting observation. I think it's Shiny Hunters, using conversational AI like Bland AI to completely automate and the use of AI for it, that voice phishing, which obviously that's enabling it to scale and it's making it that much, much larger problem. So just to move things along, although we're not going too far, we obviously talked about Scattered Spider, and you've alluded to it, Patrick. But yeah, we've seen that collaboration between groups, and as you say, in the music world, we'd probably call them super groups. A little bit like Traveling Wilburys, which is an example that's showing my age there. But in this instance, we've got Scattered Lapsus Hunters. And they were obviously, again, you hinted to it, responsible for compromising Jaguar Land Rover. So, Patrick, just as our lead honest and response and threat intelligence in the organization and in this group, what can you tell us about, not briefly-ish, about scattered Lapsus hunters?
So they are a super group. They're loosely federated. So there's not kind of a central government or central management of them. They all, I think that the main thing is that they all have the same modus operandi. They have the same motivations, which is obviously finance, making money off these attacks. And they've realized it's better to all work together and offer like an affiliate style kind of service offering to each other. So they'll all have different pros and cons and different offerings to each other, and they'll help each other out. For example, one might be strong in on the AI side, the initial access, and the other might be strong on the ransomware side. But yeah, so they're just a loosely connected cyber criminal group,
Yeah, well, although similar actors, what kind of, I guess, what are the similarities and what sets it apart from the retail attacks?
I mean, obviously the Scattered Spider guys, those guys responsible for the for the retail attack. And then obviously the JLR one, the other groups got involved, and then I think the similarities are that they all just want money. Basically, they all just want to compromise for financial gain. In terms of like differences, I don't see many differences between the actual methods that they use. So it's all kind of, initial access through a third party, or some kind of social engineering. They don't really use kind of APT based, your traditional vulnerabilities, like 0 days and stuff like that. They're more interested in the social engineering side. So I'd say there's a lot more similarities than differences in the groups.
Yeah, well, that's it. And that's, as you say, once they're in, living off the land, using legitimate remote access or remote management tools, that we've got to make sure that we have the capability to identify that across the entire environment, so that we can, hopefully, very much like Harrods, although we don't know all the details there, mitigate it as soon as possible. And obviously, Martin, you mentioned Jaguar Land Rover impacting, well beyond the UK manufacturing plants. In fact, actually, it was talked about in the House of Commons and other reports in the UK because of the direct impact it had on the economy, that it was that large. And obviously, Brian, we talked about third parties that impacted, third party after third party, third, fourth, and fifth party and beyond, in terms of the supply chain. But it kind of really highlights that, in this instance, they've looked at how they can really disrupt an organization, which is around that manufacturing side. So there's definitely an OT aspect to this attack. So I guess the question, Brian, is OT becoming, one of the top targets for attackers?
Yes, it is. In fact, there has been a massive increase in threat actors targeting the OT sector and the industrial sector, somewhere in the region of a 60% increase. And the reasons are quite obvious in that, very often these type of environments, the actual material cost of downtime, of losing business continuity, is massive. Literally a few hours of production time could equate, from a cost perspective, to a very handsome ransom for the threat actor. And it's a very high stakes type environment, and that's coupled as well with the fact that many of these environments do, have weak security. They might have legacy unpatched systems. We're seeing, many organizations in this sector haven't really put in proper segmentation, and actually 70% of attacks in OT environments originate from the IT environment, or over 70%. So that segmentation piece is also quite critical as well. So for that reason, yeah, the number of OT attacks are going up, the number of threat actors targeting, and the number of successful breaches are going up as well, and unfortunately, in that sector.
Just,
And
sorry, Rich, I was gonna just kind of pose a question there, to dig a little bit further into that. And I think a few years back when we started seeing extortion being added on to ransomware attacks, so they started doing data exfiltration and then extortion. I always thought that we would just move away from the ransomware and just use extortion, but obviously, these actors want to have the best chance of getting a ransom, and having impact seems like that obviously gives them the better chance. And attacking OT environments is as good as shutting down, computers, but for manufacturing plants. So just an interesting, I think, approach that we're moving away from. And I don't know, maybe Patrick can chip in on this. Maybe asking money for data leakage is not as effective as these groups are hoping was going to be the case. And so they're relying more on disrupting activities in terms of revenue making possibilities.
My experience of OT is that if you were to disrupt an OT environment rather than an IT environment, we're talking industrial control systems, machines, all that kind of stuff, the impact is much bigger because Not only are they more complex, but they're often running, legacy operating systems. I had one client last year that the software that was being run for this engineering system wasn't even made anymore. So they literally couldn't get it. They couldn't bring it up again. They couldn't get another copy of it. It was just ruined. Obviously, it's more expensive as well. Whereas IT, if you've got good backups, you can kind of restore everything, from snapshots. So I can definitely see the fruit of going for these OT environments. In terms of like the stats on success of attacks and getting money from breaches. I mean, I've got a friend who's a ransomware negotiator, and they're extremely busy. Like they facilitate probably 4 or 5 crypto payments for ransom payment a day. So it's definitely not quieting down in terms of ransom payments. Companies are very much paying. Whether those are OT versus IT, I'm not sure. And I think it all depends on the breach itself. So we've had clients that got that. Yeah, they just had the disruption. They didn't have any data stolen, but that's very rare. So I'd say data stolen is almost like 99% of incidents these days, and data is stolen, and then disruption is maybe 70%, I would say 60%.
And
So
actually, Patrick, you had a there was an interesting stat in our trends and predictions guide, where you had found in the incidents we handled last year that it was over 95% data exfiltration in ransomware events versus up from 70% the prior year. So pretty much in all cases, the threat actors are going for double or triple extortion as part of that.
Yeah.
But
So
just going back to Martin's very interesting point about the fact that now ransomware is coming, encryption is coming, and locking systems is coming back into vogue in OT environments. Interestingly, in the JLR, getting back to JLR, there was a lot, 350 gig of data stolen from their Jira tenant earlier in the year through a third-party compromise, which mapped out the network and all the critical infrastructure. So all that leaked data, if you like, armed the threat actor to actually go ahead and find a way around and deploy the ransomware. So I think it was like a dual attack where both the data exfiltration and the encryption was of benefit to the threat actor in that case.
I mean, the JLR attack was very well planned. They had access to the Jira, months before. They would have to have spent a lot of time digesting all that information, understanding it. That was a very well planned out attack. Just, I mean, in my opinion, stealing data is a lot easier than disrupting a network, because in order to disrupt a network like really well, you'd have to understand, what are the critical assets. What's the best way of disrupting this network? Like if often threat actors don't know the strength of a customer's, backups and recovery plans. So it's actually whereas the data, it's easy. You just lift and shift the data, and then you've got all their data basically. It's a lot easier to do that than to, spend time understanding the customer's network, how to properly disrupt them, which is what they did in the JLR one, with the Jira access. So
And too many of them, have a bit of a root cause in flat networks, that we haven't got their segmentation in place, that you mentioned, Brian. And I would sort of say that actually, there's obviously a core and key recommendation and lessons learned that we've seen from OT attacks, like JLR. To make sure that segmentation is in place as a bare minimum. But I would go further, and I mentioned that buzzword a little while ago of zero trust, but really it's around building those boundaries to put as much segmentation in as possible so that we control access and ideally do that down to the identity layer. So that is definitely something that that is, if it isn't in place, should be on everyone's cards to be reviewing. And actually, there's tools that most people have at their fingertips. Most people are a Microsoft customer. I was talking with our head of our Microsoft services, Sam Lambert, Monday, around this entire subject, and he is finding that many organizations aren't making use of the conditional access, the capabilities that they have in Entra and beyond. So they're there, and I think the thing that we need to make sure is that we're actually utilizing them to protect our identities, protect access to our environments. And the knock-on effect there is obviously that when they're in place, that we can detect them, detect anomalous behavior nice and early as well. So just again, just to keep the conversation going and moving, so that we now. I'm not going to step us too far away again, because I want to just touch upon, one of the other big attacks, which was linked and carried out by scattered Lapsus hunters, but slightly different in nature, and that was SalesLoft and the Drift integration. So Patrick, I'll just come to you. You're stealing all the airtime today, but I'm just going to come to you again, and if you just give us a quick synopsis, what can you tell us about this attack?
So this one was it's the similar, slightly different. So it was a supply chain attack on an organization called SalesLoft. So they have a public repository. Well, it's actually private, but they got compromised. So technically public, or a GitHub. So they had a GitHub account with all of their kind of workflows, all of their code in. That got breached via a guest user, and then. The attacker used that to then pivot into their AWS environment, where a lot of the kind of like the underlying code was stored, and then most importantly the tokens, so the OAuth tokens that were used. And basically, the way the SalesLoft works is that SalesLoft is an add-on to Salesforce. It's called SOQL, which is Salesforce. I can't remember the full acronym, but SOQL queries to Salesforce to pull the data back and then provide a. I think SalesLoft is used for a chat program that you can add to Salesforce. So essentially, the attackers, once they had the OAuth creds, the tokens, they then masqueraded as SalesLoft users and then stole a load of data from Salesforce. So essentially, that's the supply chain attack.
Yeah,
So.
and so there's an element there of sort of SaaS security posture management that arguably you could say that wasn't there to make sure that that the Git was protected in the first instance. But Martin, we're seeing a lot of token theft, session hijacking, in general. Now I know we're getting into the weeds on this, particularly from quite, a nice technical perspective in next week's webinar. So there's a shameless plug for it. But as a teaser, can you kind of explain, why we're seeing this? What was the challenge that, why is it being targeted so much?
Yeah, I think it's just the cat and mouse game that we're constantly in with these threat actors, in that we put in a defense and they learn how to bypass the defense, and that previous defense was two-factor authentication. Years ago, we thought, no, we got to get everyone on 2FA, and then this phishing problem is going to be gone. And what happened? They just find ways to bypass it. And this token session hijacking is just another way of them bypassing the security controls that we so hard worked to put in place. But it's just part of the game. We gotta keep up with it. And no doubt, the controls that we put in today, or they're going to be bypassed in the years coming. And we just gotta keep up with that cat and mouse game. So yeah, it's just threat actors adapting to the controls that we're putting in and learning how to bypass them. It's r remarkable how resourceful they are to bypass these attacks or bypass these defenses. So yeah, it's just what we got to deal with. This is what's part of being in the security industry.
Yeah, and very difficult to identify as well, which is why we're diving deep down into it next week. So recommendations and lessons learned and insights for that one. Tune in next week, Wednesday, I believe. So just John, we're going to run out of time, and I see there's some questions in that I definitely want us to get round to. But there's just one last breach, because I think there's some important kind of things there to think about, which is slightly different to the rest, and that is Collins Aerospace. So back in September, I believe it was the 19th of September, They were compromised, and Patrick, I'll let you talk through the compromise in a second. But obviously, again, in this instance, being highly disruptive to systems that in this instance ran airports, check-ins, and beyond, affecting a number of airports, Brussels, Heathrow, and others. So Patrick, just there's a few important points here that we can point to some learnings that we can take from this.
These guys, Collins Aerospace, they have a platform that is used across various different airports. It's called vMuse, or Virtual Muse. Essentially, what it does is it allows the booking system, the processing for check-ins. So, when you check in, you put your luggage through the machine. It basically makes sure all the information goes through, including passport data as well. So that's the system that was compromised. It was exploited. Actually, the company was exploited via a 2022 breach of an InfoStealer infection on an employee device. So, from three years ago, credentials had not been rotated. So there's a lessons learned there. As a result of that, the check-in platform got compromised, and then a load of airlines lost their access. So it was quite a big impact for various different flights and stuff. Rich, the lessons learned. Credentials weren't rotated. They didn't have any kind of any indication that these credentials were stolen either. So, some sort of digital risk protection service, out there looking, scanning for exposed creds would be a good one as well, I think.
Yeah,
I
indeed.
think.
Oh, sorry.
Sorry, Rich. I was just going to say something interesting about that attack was that there was actually two threat actors engaged with the client unknowingly that the other was engaged at the same time. And this is surprisingly more common than we think. I think when we get involved and look do forensic investigations and really dig down deep into a machine that has known to be compromised, you often find other artifacts from previous attacks that have maybe happened. The really coincidental thing was that these threat actors were actually in the customer at the same time. So just an interesting
And interestingly,
tidbit about that.
related to the last discussion, one of them decided to exfiltrate the data, and the other one decided to encrypt the data. So presumably, the team that got the data out got in first, so that they get the data before it was encrypted.
Yeah, what I liked, Martin, is that you referred to them as being engaged in the client, which is a very nice way for the threat actors to look at them rather than just a target. So I tell you,
Victims is the
we're
right
gonna
word.
leave. I think we'll leave it there for sort of our discussion and jump into some of the questions. So the first question we've got in here is, are you seeing signs of attackers using advanced capabilities like agentic AI plus MCPs and model context protocol servers that have been reported globally? Obviously, the key aspect of this question is whether AI plus MCP has been productionized yet. I'll let anybody else jump in there, but I just this is something myself and a good number of the team attended DEF CON last year, where one of the talks was from the team at Anthropic, just showing how Claude AI paired with an MCP server can be given the parameters to take part in a CTF, and actually was hugely successful up to a certain point. So although I don't know if we're seeing activity from that, that's actually going to be one of the things that I think we will see a hell of a lot more over the course of next year, is that becoming productionized, becoming realistic. I think it's going to change the way that we look at threat actor use of AI. Going from, last year we were talking about, well, actually it's writing code, doing analysis a little bit, that much quicker. The same as developers using it for more effective phishing campaigns into deep fakes. But I would say that the developing world of AI and agentic AI is really going to come into play, going beyond what the Shiny Hunters team were doing in terms of voice phishing with conversational AI, but taking it into that ability to scale and carry out the attacks more than just beyond doing a scan and identifying there's a weakness here that we can exploit, actually being able to take those further steps, as you have that ability to just describe the persona, and this is your job, go on and do it. I don't know if anybody else has got anything else to add in there.
Yeah, I think certainly it has been productionized for phishing campaigns by large scales. A lot of the phishing campaigns we're seeing are really looking, compared to 5 years ago, or even 3 years ago, they're just, there's no doubt that AI is involved in putting those campaigns together. So I think from that perspective, maybe from a more advanced perspective, not as common yet, but like you say, Richard, definitely something that we can anticipate going into 2026.
Yeah. The next question, just scrolled off there. Are there any lessons to learn from how the discovery of the attacks happened, i.e., scene processing and anomaly detection? Which I think the answer is, roughly not. I mean, I think the detection of it in, excuse me, Marks and Spencer's case was everything went down. From the co-op group, I believe it was direct interaction over Teams to senior members of staff as part of the extortion process. But I could be wrong. But Patrick, have you got any kind of insights there? I mean, we can give plenty of general insights, and particularly from what you guys have responded to, of how they've been identified versus the gap there that was missing.
With the major breaches, like these big orgs, that they very often, like 90% of the time, do have some sort of SIEM in place and anomaly detection. They'll have a strong EDR, because they'll typically have a good budget. It's more on the human side of it. So the monitoring, that initial access, once the attackers are in, they use the social engineering side to get in. Sophisticated attackers like these guys that in Easter last year, they'll use living off the land. So these, anomaly scene processing, anomaly detection, it's getting increasingly harder to detect these guys, due to using living off the land tooling. So really, it's just a test of how good your SOC is, really, to putting two and two together, to see see how.
If I can chip in here, often I think Harrods is probably the exception there, in that they actually stopped the attack earlier. But often when you're reading about these breaches, they didn't detect it. That's why it's in the headlines. So you often have more learnings from some of the earlier stage attacks that we see, for instance, in our MDR service, where you can, all these attacks start with something simple. And when you pick that up and you can, dig a little bit deeper and get some more TTPs, that's obviously a good place to learn as well. Just something in terms of, because most of these breaches, and I think if you read the Verizon breach report, most of the breaches they get reported on are breaches where the customer was or the victim was notified by a third party, in other words, or disruption, which is not a good message from a detection perspective.
No, and actually, just we're gonna have to get on to some other questions, and we probably won't have a chance to answer them all, but we will follow up with the answers from the team. But yeah, on that theme, and I know something that Patrick, you saw in a breach you responded to. It's probably 2 or 3 years ago now, and I'm sure you'll remember it. But we've seen instances of where customers do have that ability to detect. I know there's that one that the team investigated where they had an industry leading EDR platform, they had an industry leading network detection and response platform, yet they were still breached. And it's not a problem with the platforms, because they were triggering, firing, not necessarily in the blocking mode on the EDR front, but both providing those alerts. But they got off to an inbox. Because there was just too noisy, didn't have the people. Technology is not purely an answer. I think the technology needs to be in place to be able to cover all bases, and I think that's where detection is changing. We've seen that evolution. It's why we're talking about XDR and making looking at that broad capability to detect across the entire environment. And then it's just critically important that you have the team and the processing power, which is going to be enhanced by AI, but obviously keeping a human in the loop to be able to sieve through that and identify, what we need to focus on. So I'll tell you what, I'll leave that question there. We've got 4 minutes. We do like to cap this as the at the hour. So as I said, if we don't answer anything, we will answer afterwards. There's a question around lessons learned for shared IT services, which if compromised can affect more than one organization. And it's a good point, actually. Yes, there was three London councils that were hit, or but they had shared services between them. If I put that out to the team, anybody got some views on actually what we should be doing when it comes to third-party shared IT services? Because I think that's a slightly different challenge.
I still think it's a form of third-party risk management. If you like, the shared IT provider is the third party, and all of the clients, the councils, are the customers. So obviously, the shared provider needs to up their game in terms of their security and their people, their training, the process, and technology. But from the actual client perspective, they need to think of it as a almost like a pseudo third-party risk, and build, business continuity planning and testing to incorporate third parties, whether they be internal or external third parties, incorporating that into their planning and their business continuity testing as well.
Yeah, and I guess it's insulating, as we kind of said. And I will say that that was very well responded to in terms of execution of the incident response plan, right down to how do we deliver those services, in a crisis, which has obviously had been planned and rehearsed. So just another data point to kind of say actually preparation, preparation, preparation. So Joe, we're pretty much out of time. There's one more. Well, there's plenty of questions that we need to answer in here, but there's one here that I'm going to give each of you 30 seconds to give your answer. What is one recommendation you would make based on what happened in 2025?
Who first?
Go on,
I'll go
Martin. Sorry,
first.
I should probably, yeah, go on, Martin. You're on my left on the screen here.
Yeah, so I'm gonna go. I think it's somewhere in our report as well. Identity is the new perimeter. So really focus on identity, and if you look at these breaches that we're talking about today, and most of the ones that we're seeing, stolen credentials, phishing. That's still the most common factor that we're seeing in these attacks, from my perspective, and that's something I would really focus on, to lock down.
Go there, Brian, you're next on my screen.
Well, I'm flying
You've
the
probably got
flag
10
for
seconds.
third-party risk management at the moment. So it determine who owns third-party risk management, and if it doesn't exist, assign centralized ownership with cross-functional engagement in that.
Patrick.
Just to add on to Brian's there, had a breach where there was four IT providers for one company, and it was absolute chaos when investigating the incident. So yeah, just to echo that, risk management for IT providers, but yeah, just recovery for me, having a recovery plan is absolute key. It's
Perfect.
mine.
Well, thank you very much. We are hard up on time. I do want to just make them aware of our upcoming webinar next week, Beyond the Inbox, the hidden tactics behind modern business email compromise attacks that we're going to dive down into. So I'm just going to say, as we wrap this up, thank you very much for the team that have joined me today on this. So Martin, Brian, and Patrick. And also very much to say, thank you to everybody that's joined and interacted. I think it'd be a great webinar. Thanks all.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Cheers
Cheers.
all. Bye bye bye.